Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has done an extraordinary job over decades now and in various incarnations of documenting and helping the rest of us understand this phenomenon of the war for the free world, as I call it, is our first guest. He is Roger Kimball. He is the editor and publisher of a splendid publication, The New Criterion, and the president and publisher of Encounter Books, which has a tremendous list of books that address this very point, the struggle of our time, the struggle of previous generations as well as our own with existential threats to freedom. Roger Kimball, it is so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Well, Frank, it's terrific to be with you.
Listen, we're being told on a fairly continuous loop at the moment that this is the anniversary of Robert F. Kennedy's assassination. It's also, as you've pointed out, the 50th anniversary of the Cultural Revolution, what has been called the Long March through the institutions and otherwise. You've reflected on that recently at PJ Media, the second of these anniversaries. Would you talk a little bit about it?
Yes. Well, of course, Robert Kennedy, the whole phenomenon of Robert Kennedy is part of that, his rise, but also his assassination. The Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, we like to think of as being behind us. I mean, after all, 1968 was 50 years ago. But in fact, I think that we are still living very much in the shadow of that curious time, that revolutionary time, really. I think the 1960s and 70s, it was a long decade. It didn't really end until the rise of Ronald Reagan. And it turns out that it hasn't ended even yet. It turns out that the 1960s changed the way we think about ourselves, the way we think about our country, the way we think about what constitutes the good life, the way we think about everything from international relations to the way we comport ourselves with one another as social beings, sexual beings.
As a society.
As a society. You know, we think sometimes that the ideas of Freud, let's say, or Marx are old hat now. We've gotten beyond all of that. But it turns out that we haven't gotten beyond it. We've institutionalized it. And that, I believe, is what's happened with the 1960s. It is a fundamental challenge to the wisdom of the West. And it's a challenge that we still have not fully replied to, although I can see a few heartening signs on the horizon.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be speaking momentarily with Daniel Pipes, who, in fact, is forecasting some promising developments for Western civilization. Despite all of that, which you've described, it's very much, I think, on his mind as well as ours and on yours, obviously, your newest book being Vox Populi, Perils and Promises of Populism. Before we turn to Daniel on that subject as well, let me just ask you about the man you've just mentioned, Ronald Reagan, who 30 years ago was confronting the Soviets in their own capital, having come to power on a program of trying to take them down, which, as it happens, Daniel Pipes' dad, Richard Pipes, was instrumental in bringing about. Talk a little bit about the Reagan legacy here and the alternative course that it really chartered for our country from, you know, what the left and, for that matter, their Islamist allies have in mind for us.
Yes. Well, I think that if we look back 30 years rather than 50 years, we have a much more beneficent prospect before us, because 30 years ago, on May 31st, we saw Ronald Reagan go to Moscow, 3 days in Moscow, and he gave a speech at Moscow State University, which now here we have a new, friendlier Reagan. This is not the Reagan of the evil empire And, when asked a decade or so earlier, his ideas about the Cold War, he said, "We win, they lose," which is a pretty crisp summary. But he understood that his task in Moscow was to present the other side of the picture, to go and speak to these thousands of students standing underneath a bust of Lenin about the opportunities, the advantages of freedom. This was a speech about freedom. It was about the attractions of the West and how, if they could only embrace freedom and throw off the shackles that a communist tyranny had imposed upon them since 1917, how much happier, more prosperous, more fulfilled, more civilized they would be. And Reagan, you remember at the time how the media hated him. How dare he refer to the Soviet Union as an evil empire? What a stupid moron he was to talk about the Strategic Defense Initiative, and on and on and on. It sounds a little bit like the media today about another political figure. But what you saw was he understood that his mantra here was peace through strength. From time immemorial, wise politicians have understood that if you want to get along with people, if you want freedom to flourish, then you must be strong, economically strong, strong in military terms, and strong spiritually. Let's not forget that. And Reagan's speech at Moscow State University was not so much a call to arms, but a call to freedom. And it turned out, of course, in 1988, the very next year, we saw the fall of the Berlin Wall.
This is sort of the connective tissue, it seems to me, that having warned, as he did, that every generation faces an existential threat to freedom, he knew in his time it was Soviet communism, and he set about implementing that strategy of we win, they lose. And Richard Pipes, of whom we'll speak in a moment with Daniel, was one of the architects of National Security Decision Directive 75, which really set in train his strategy for taking down the USSR. And there he is in Moscow, really sort of bringing it home to them just a few years later.
Yes, well, something you said, Frank, I think is absolutely right on. We really have to keep this in focus. It's something that Reagan said decades before, I think it was before he was even governor of California, he observed that freedom is never won all at once. It must be re-won in every generation. And you can never rest on your laurels. The existential threat is renewed for every generation. And I think that that's something that we would do well to contemplate today as we find a whole host of threats. External, I'm with China and indeed Russia, but internal too. I mean, in my mind, one of the greatest threats to our freedom and security and prosperity, but above all our freedom, is what some people have called the administrative state, the growth of this self-engorging, unelected, unaccountable federal and state government bureaucracy.
Now better known as the deep state. Yeah. Roger Kimball, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time, as well as this so impressive contribution you make in so many different ways. Come back to us again soon, my friend, if you will. Daniel Pipes up next.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I am thrilled to say we are joined by a man who I believe was the very first interview we did in the founding program of this Secure Freedom Radio. He is Dr. Daniel Pipes, a man who has over the years rendered extraordinary service to our country, both in government and in the world of ideas, notably in his role as the founder and president of the Middle East Forum based in Philadelphia. He is an affiliate professor at the University of Haifa as well, the author of, well, more books than you can shake a stick at, quite literally, most of them dealing with the Middle East or national security and public policy in various ways. and all of them with an acuity and a clarity of thought that is truly inspirational. It's a great privilege to call him a friend as well as a colleague and to welcome him back to Secure Freedom Radio. Daniel, good to have you.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you for the very warm introduction.
Well, it's going to get warmer because I wanted to say something about your dad, who unfortunately passed away recently, Dr. Richard Pipes. Man, I didn't know terribly well, but admired greatly for his work in some of the same spheres that you've operated in, of course, a specialist in Russia. But I think particularly fondly of the incredibly important role he played in chairing something that I think came to be known as the Team B analysis, exercise in competitive analysis for then it ultimately wound up serving, I should say, the then candidate Ronald Reagan, and served as a platform really for his presidency, part of which your father served in at the National Security Council. So we're, you know, so sorry about his passing. He lived a very full life, and I know he will be much missed by you, but also by the rest of us. And I just wanted to say a word of thanks to you for that as well.
Thank you, Frank.
So let me ask you about something you've recently written on, Daniel, in keeping with your general practice. It's a bit provocative, but it's very thoughtful and thought-provoking. I believe it appeared in The Australian, and you entitled it The Rise of Western Civilization. There's a lot of gloom and doom about what's happening with Western civilization. Walk us through why you take some comfort from at least some life still being seen in the old Western civ in parts of the world.
There has been a very large, uncontrolled immigration to Western countries. I think it's just the beginning, that there are about hundreds of millions of people from poor, less well-governed countries who wish to come to the West. It is, I think, one of the great problems of the future. But it's already a problem, and it's already stirring much unrest, especially in Western, Northwestern Europe, but also in Australia, Canada, and even to a certain extent in the United States. Much of the focus is on the immigrants and what they're doing, and the left and its appeasement of the immigrants, and particularly Muslim immigrants, and most especially Islamist immigrants. That is to say, Muslim immigrants who wish to bring with them the Sharia, the Islamic law, and apply Islamic norms in the West. This is, of course, a major confrontation that's underway. To a small extent, it's violent, but to a much greater extent, it's in the institutions of government, of education, of the media, and of the courts, and so forth. As I say, most of the focus is on the Islamists and their leftist appeasers. I think, in contrast, that there is something very profound that's taking place, which is a reaction, a negative reaction to the Islamists and their leftist appeasers. It's growing. It is, I think, going to be a very powerful force in the future. You can already see that it has come to power in various forms in Austria and now in Italy. I think we're likely to see it in Germany and France and Sweden and elsewhere. I think these ideas, which are still raw, unformulated, somewhat cranky, full of problems, pro-Putin, anti-Semitic, and whatnot, are going to evolve in a more solid and more mature direction. I think they will be the rulers of the West. I call them civilizationist parties because they're not really nationalist. They're not particularly interested in France and Germany and Britain. They're interested in Western civilization. I don't call them far right because they have quite a bit of leftist policies in them. They're populist, to be sure, but they're populist parties on the left as well, so that's not a very good description. So I've come up with two words. One is civilizationist, which describe what their goals are to protect Western civilization. The other is resistance. These are the resistance parties. They want to keep things as they are. They don't want to have wholesale changes take place.
This is not to be confused, of course, with the resistance we hear much about in our own country, of resistance to a civilizationist president, I think it would be fair to call him, given what you've just described. Let me ask you to drill down on two things in that very important exposition of your thesis, Daniel Pipes. One is, there is a lot of caviling, shall we say, about this process of migrants coming in and whether they are seeking, in fact, to impose Sharia on Western civilization to the great detriment of freedom and the values that, that it is enshrined and advanced for centuries. Some have gone so far as to say, well, this is all a conspiracy theory that has been pronounced by, well, the likes of the NB. How do you respond to that?
I respond by saying this is the left at work. The left, fundamentally, what is the definition of the left? In some sense, there are many different ways of doing it, but one is that it doesn't like Western civilization. It is always looking for the problems, always seeing it negatively. I mean, think of, say, Howard Zinn's People's History of America. It is nothing but a history of sins, of bad things. If you read that, you think the United States is a horrible place. The left is critical, deeply critical, fundamentally doesn't like the basics of Western civilization. And so the West has found in the Islamists a fellow anti-Western faction. And they work together. They have different goals, to be sure, but they work together in practice. And of course, the left uses Saul Alinsky's tactics and uses the politics of personal defamation and calls us names, calls us racists and xenophobes and conspiracy theorists and so forth. But we are not. We are mainstream conservatives who are interested in maintaining our way of life, who like the Constitution and don't want it replaced by the Quran. There is a very real effort by Islamists to impose their will. Just a couple of days ago, Keith Ellison announced he's quitting the U.S. Congress. Well, on first blush, that's good news. He is, I would say, an Islamist. But he's going to run for Attorney General. And, of course, Attorney General of Minnesota is a stepping stone to Governor of Minnesota. Imagine that. We could have an Islamist governing a U.S. state within some years. These things are looming ahead of us.
They're not conspiracy theories. They may, in fact, be just simply conspiracies. And one of the things that I've been struck by, Daniel, is, and again, your use of this term civilizationist to describe those who are standing athwart this program, this agenda, is interesting because, as you know, a book that really lays out in very stark terms the nature of this, well, I call it Sharia supremacist conspiracy in our country, written by Muhammad Akram, a top Muslim Brotherhood operative back in 1991, is he uses this term civilization jihad. So it really sets up exactly the choice.
Yes, it does. I wouldn't call the Islamist surge a conspiracy, in the sense that there is no central body in Tehran or someplace else that is plotting this out. It is spontaneous. It is not conspiratorial. So I don't think we who are afraid of this are conspiracy theorists, nor do I think they on the other side are conspiracy actors, conspiracists.
Let me just clarify the point, because I think there's something to what you said. But I think inherent in the doctrine of Sharia is what you might call a program, a plan, an agenda, or an implementation, a conspiracy, to assure that that code is dominant the world over. And again, I wouldn't choose that term, but to contrast it with what Andy McCarthy is fond of saying, you know, there is no conspiracy without a conspiracy theory. So when one is, you know, ascribed these characteristics of conspiracy theorists, I think that it's at least important to say, wait a minute, where the facts point to an actual plan of action that is being executed consistent with a plan that was introduced, as you know, Daniel, so well, into evidence by the federal government of the United States, no less, in the Holy Land Foundation trial. It's fair to say it is something that we ignore at our peril. Whatever one calls it, it is an agenda for our destruction and must be resisted. And I commend you for coining this term civilizationist. I think it's a great way to characterize our friends there. Let me ask you about one specific threat, and you contributed handsomely to a book that we wrote on the subject recently entitled Turkey, Ally No More. You have followed closely the trajectory of one of these Sharia supremacist operations, namely that of Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey. Daniel Pipes, give us your current reading on the Turks, their role in all of this, the immigration and so on. And lastly, whether it's advisable under the present circumstances for us to be sharing F-35 state-of-the-art U.S. military hardware with the Turks?
Last question is an easy one. No, it's a terrible idea, in part because we can't assume that the Turks will keep the information to themselves. They might share it with the Russians, in part because we might face our own F-35s in some future conflict. That's a ghastly idea, and it's very important that the Congress stop this before it begins in just some months. More broadly, Erdogan has evolved from being a very careful, a long-term builder of the economy, a diplomat, conciliator in his first roughly decade, to being an out-and-out authoritarian, a dictator, a despot. The elections, which are coming up in, 18 days, are basically a fraud from my point of view.
Daniel, we are over time. There's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, again, bless you. We'll talk soon. Next up, we will speak with Bill Marshall of Judicial Watch right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined, it's a pleasure to say, once again by Bill Marshall. He is a senior investigator at Judicial Watch, an organization that I think has become immortalized for many of us by the work of Bill and Tom Fitton and Chris Farrell and others on their team in exposing scandals that have largely gone unremarked or at least unaddressed by the United States Congress. Certainly unaddressed in terms of success in penetrating efforts to conceal or withhold information, thanks to the Freedom of Information Act provisions, which the Judicial Watch team wields with great effect. Bill Marshall, it's so good to have you back, especially since there seems to be a lot of, well, perturbations in the force, I think is what they call it in Star Wars. I'm interested in your current reading on the reports that we're getting that Michael Horowitz, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, is about to spring at long last his much-anticipated assessment of the sort of misconduct of various people, including, it seems, the Attorney General of the United States under Barack Obama, Loretta Lynch, and the Director of the FBI in that same period, James Comey. What do we know at the moment, and where do you think this is going to go?
Well, thanks for having me back, Frank. Yeah, it's breaking, essentially. The whole leaks coming out now about what's contained in the Horowitz report, which largely focuses on the email, you know, the Hillary email Clinton investigation handling, or investigation as it, you know, such as it was, I guess you would say.
Such as it was is the right way to put it.
Right. You know, I think we're all just sort of waiting with bated breath here to find out how hard these people are going to be hammered, who should be, including Loretta Lynch and James Comey and, you know, Peter Strzok and all these characters who in my view, you know, and I think in the view of most people, sought to bury, you know, Hillary's really egregious abuse of national security information and you know, government records generally. I mean, she was not a babe in the woods. She knew exactly what she was doing in the way she, you know, handled her work-related emails, specifically to avoid the Federal Records Act.
And that was the case as well, I think it's fair to say, of a number of her lieutenants and lawyers at the State Department. One of her right-hand women, I guess it's accurate to say, is Huma Abedin. And of course, you have been delving in to the extent you can at Judicial Watch for years now into the matters of what was done and said and transacted by the Clinton State Department that really was evidence of corruption at the highest levels, of malfeasance, and of compromise of national security. Just walk us through a little bit of what you've learned to date and where you are in terms of trying to get access to what James Comey, as I understand it, said were hundreds of thousands of emails that have thus far been withheld from you in your FOIA efforts.
Right. It's just a little over 3 years that I started delving into Huma Abedin's, non.gov, that is to say personal personal server-based emails, involving Hillary and the State Department. I filed my FOIA request, my original one, March 18th of 2015. We then filed suit on that. This was for all of Huma Abedin's work-related emails transmitted on a non.gov, that is a non-State Department email account. We then filed a lawsuit on May 5th of 2015, and we started getting a trickle initially of Huma's emails in September of 2015, and that trickle became a flood. And the timing, was really serendipitous because the revelations, as you mentioned, were devastating to Hillary's campaign. And in revealing the corruption, just the massive corruption she was engaged in with the state through the State Department and the Clinton Foundation, the pay for play for donors to the Clinton Foundation, getting favors from the State Department, and I think some would argue. Less importantly, I think, as a former government employee, I think more importantly was the abuse, the really gross abuse of national security information. I mean, she was trafficking, thousands of classified documents were transmitted on her, on her system, on her unsecure email system, and including, I believe, I want to say it was 22 top secret emails. This is, special access program material that could get people killed if it. So it's been going on for 3 years, and then we got, I think, 20 productions of Huma's emails over the course of those 3 years, which, as I say, were really instrumental in bringing to light so much of the corruption of Hillary Clinton. But we've continued to battle, as you know, back in October 28th, I believe, 2016, James Comey revealed that the sexual deviant Anthony Weiner was found to have thousands of Hillary Clinton's emails on his personal laptop, in Huma's personal laptop that Huma had transmitted to that machine. Then, miraculously, the FBI was able, in the span of about a week, to get through those hundreds of thousands of emails and declare, Hillary innocent or whatever in his incredible handling of and closure of the Hillary email case, the FBI's Hillary email case. You'll recall that in July of 2016, he made his really breathtaking, I won't call it a press conference because no questions were taken, but his speech to the press claiming that Hillary was extremely careless in her use of government information, but not grossly negligent, which was the statutory terminology, if you will, that would bring about a felony charge. So he basically buried or tanked the investigation. But we've continued that fight because, we wanted access to all of Huma's work-related emails that were contained on Anthony Weiner's laptop. The FBI then turned over to the State Department an undetermined amount of those emails, and we have since been provided with about 3,000 additional emails that we had not been provided before that were found on Weiner's laptop that were Huma work-related emails. Those also contained classified, I think there were 18 classified documents, and they also revealed more pay-for-play corruption. But the point is that the State Department has been trying to dismiss our case for Huma Abedin's emails, but we argued in our motion, which we submitted just recently in the last week to the court, we opposed the State Department's motion for summary judgment to dismiss the case because we never received which they are required to provide. We never received a detailed search declaration, which would specify exactly how many emails the FBI turned over to the State Department from that were Huma Abedin work-related emails, what search terms were used, what the criteria were used for determining whether emails were work-related or not work-related. The FOIA statute makes it incumbent upon the government agency from whom records have been requested to demonstrate that they have made a good faith effort to search for responsive records. And that includes detailing for us exactly what steps they took, what databases were searched, what search terms were used, what timeframes were searched.
Basic accountability, in other words. And this probably sounds to most of our listeners, Bill, as pretty much in the weeds kind of work. And yet I think it's been so critical to the results that you and your colleagues have achieved at Judicial Watch over the years, to not only understand the workings of these bureaucratic operations, but also to use them to assure accountability for all of us that are being otherwise denied information that may bear directly on, well, as we say, even our national security. And I commend you for it greatly. Let me ask you about one other thing, Bill. In much of the current critique of people like myself and others of us who have been worried about the penetration of our government by people with associations with Sharia supremacism, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or other organizations. And Michelle Bachmann and several of her colleagues, as you know, a few years ago, wrote letters to five agencies in the United States government, including the State Department, asking about specific individuals who seemed, based in part on research we had done at the Center for Security Policy, to have such ties. When you hear people sort of dismiss concerns about Huma Abedin's family background and personal associations, for that matter, with the Muslim Brotherhood or Saudi operations that funded it, what's your response?
I equate sort of the threat posed by civilization jihad, if you will, to the communist threat back in the 1940s and 50s. We, as you know, in conducting background investigations on potential government employees, any hint of association with or membership in the Communist Party would have precluded you from obtaining a security clearance. That mindset was completely vitiated or maybe done away with in the Obama administration when it came to potential radical Islamists infiltrating our government. And I'm hopeful that it has been restored under the Trump administration. But when you look at people like Huma Abedin and the associations that she has had and her family has had at very high levels of the with the Muslim Brotherhood and Brotherhood Front organizations, it's mind-boggling that she achieved the position that she did, the really pivotal position within the State Department with access to the most sensitive information.
The Deputy Chief of Staff, for heaven's sakes, under Hillary Clinton. And as you say, with access to her emails and a lot more besides. Well, Bill, this is a subject for a further conversation with you, I hope, in the near future, because there's a lot of poo-pooing of it or efforts to dismiss as conspiracy theories the important points that you've just made so well. And I appreciate you doing so on our program and hope you'll come back to us again for that purpose, among others, in the near future, particularly once we have finally in hand what the Inspector General of the Department of Justice says about the case that you've been trying to make through your own means of Hillary Clinton's malfeasance and more. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we will be speaking with Thomas Popick, a man who knows a lot about one of our other existential threats to freedom, the vulnerability of our electric grid. That and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by Thomas Popick, one of the smartest guys I've come across when it comes to, well, a whole host of matters, but specifically one that ought to be top of mind for every American. And that is the issue of the resiliency of our electric grid. And if it's not resilient, what it could mean to every single one of us or someone or something to take it down. And that is the subject of our conversation with Tom Popick. Tom, I did want to say before we get into this important topic that I have failed to mention to this point, but what to do now. This important anniversary of D-Day, when in 1944, thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans and Brits and Canadians and Australians went ashore for the purposes of liberating the continent of Europe. And their service, their sacrifice in many cases, is something that should be top of mind for all of us. And I apologize to my audience that we've not addressed it until now, but I'm pleased that I have a chance to do that with you, my friend. You have been warning of, if not a D-Day, a May Day situation we may be having in our country for quite some time. And I want to salute you, Tom, for the work that you've done as one of the co-founders and as the chairman, president, director of, it sounds like Chief Cook and Bottle Washer, doesn't it? A wonderful organization, the Foundation for Resilient Societies. I know of no one who has done more than your organization to try to hold accountable the people who are supposed to be protecting us by overseeing our electric grid, specifically two organizations. We'll probably use their acronyms frequently in the course of this conversation, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, better known as FERC, and something called the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, NERC. And Tom, I wanted to just start this conversation off by discussing with you how these organizations seem to be responding to efforts that the Trump administration has been making to address and increase, hopefully, the resiliency of this very, very vital electric grid upon which all of our lives depend.
Well, certainly, Frank. I do appreciate very much the opportunity to be on your show. And I would just say at the outset that for all the casualties that the Allied forces incurred during World War II, the casualties during a single long-term blackout within the United States could exceed that by many multiples. We could be talking about millions of casualties from just a single blackout.
And these are not men in uniform that we're talking about primarily. These would be regular, ordinary American civilians, right?
Innocent civilians, yes.
And the problem is that this could be done to us by any number of enemies who understand very well our vulnerabilities in this regard, and I understand have doctrines for exploiting those vulnerabilities, but it could actually happen as a result of just Mother Nature as well. Is that right?
Correct. We could have a solar storm, such as the solar storm that impacted the province of Quebec in March 1989 and caused a province-wide blackout. A more severe incident of that sort over all of North America could cause a blackout lasting months or even years.
Wow. And needless to say, life as we know it would not be sustained if there were that kind of enduring blackout, Tom Popick. So this brings us to evidently some concern that is being expressed by President Trump and some of his senior subordinates, notably Energy Secretary Rick Perry, about the lack of resiliency. What are they trying to do about it, and how are they faring at the hands of the NERC and FERC?
Well, certainly. First of all, the Department of Energy should be applauded for their efforts to build greater resilience for the United States electric grid. Now, how are they trying to do this? It starts with a simple observation that it's important to have fuel stored on site at electric generation plants. Why? Because if the fuel is delivered just in time over, for example, a natural gas pipeline, that pipeline can be interrupted at any moment due to a cyber attack, physical attack. In some areas of the country, we have over 50% of the generation dependent on natural gas. Also, we're becoming increasingly dependent on intermittent sources such as solar power and wind power. We all know through our personal experience, the sun doesn't shine at night. There's no solar power. The wind doesn't blow all the time. And so as the country becomes more and more dependent on just-in-time fuel or intermittent power, we become closer and closer to this dreaded circumstance of a long-term blackout. Now, what is the current administration trying to do? They're saying that generators that have reliable baseload power should receive compensation consistent with their expenses. What is reliable baseload power that can operate 24 hours a day? In many cases, it's nuclear plants. It's also coal-fired plants, hydroelectric plants. But under this bizarre market system for electricity, a megawatt hour of solar or wind power is valued the same in the auction marketplace as this reliable baseload power. What's happening then
is nuclear plants are being shut down, coal-fired plants are being shut down. And this is causing resilience deficit that the administration is trying to remedy.
And so just in layman's terms, what you've just described is a public policy approach that is being stymied by interests that are actually working to make the grid more vulnerable rather than less, less resilient rather than more, in the interest of having what is deemed to be, I guess, the acceptable form of power, solar power and wind power. But as you say, Tom Popeck, it doesn't provide even the continuous power that you want, let alone stuff that would be enduring if there were real problems in the generation or distribution of power elsewhere in the grid.
Well, yes. And I hasten to add that my group doesn't promote any particular technology. We don't take money from nuclear power plant operators, for example, or coal-fired plant operators. We simply want reliable, resilient power that is adequately compensated. So if there's an alternative technology that can provide that, we're all in favor of it. But we are saying that whatever technology produces reliable power, it needs to be properly compensated.
Right. And this is the point. There are people who are claiming that Rick Perry or the president or others in the administration are taking an interest in this topic or adopting a specific approach in the interest of specific forms of power, notably coal. And this is part of the president's campaign promises to the coal industry and so on. Do you see any evidence of that? And if not, what are we to make of the seeming indifference of such people to the vulnerabilities that we're talking about, Tom, and the stakes if something, God forbid, winds up exploiting those vulnerabilities?
In the experience of my organization, this idea that President Trump and the Department of Energy's proposal for fair compensation of resilient power is somehow a bailout of the coal industry or special favor to coal barons, it's just a false media narrative. For those of us who have actually looked at the configuration and the generation capacity of the U.S. grid, done the analysis, testified in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, we know this grid is vulnerable. We know that reliable baseload power is required. However, that's not the media story. The media story is some kind of bizarre emotional story about individuals and special interests and bailouts, but that's not what the story that the numbers tell.
It's such important work, Tom Popeck, that you are about at the Foundation for Resilient Society, and because much of this is done behind the SOGI screen of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on their dockets and their responses that you file, as you say, sometimes spending years doing so, only to have them give them short shrift if any attention at all. It's really scandalous, and I just want to say that the work you do, as with Bill Marshall at Judicial Watch, in trying to hold these bureaucracies accountable is such an important public service. And I pray that we will not find that despite your best efforts and others of our team at the Secure the Grid Coalition, of which you are a critically important member, will be unavailing to spare us the kind of problems that are clearly in prospect if we don't take some important and urgent action to make our electric grid more resilient. Tom, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.